Austin. Welcome to the program. Getting off to a pretty good start this week. In many respects, you know, I feel, by the way, before I launch here, I want to give out the number. You're welcome to join us. 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. Come on down. Doing a conservative talk in the heart of one of America's most liberal college campuses, that being Tufts University, right up here at WMFO in the posh studios at Curtis Hall, as I sit in the catbird seat. I want to talk a little bit about the fact that the Democratic nominee for president, former Secretary of State and Senator Hillary Clinton, is reemerging. She has come back on the stage, as it were, in what is at least billed by The Hill and by other media outlets as her first major public appearance. I guess you would think that in such a situation, and given her position really as the titular head of the Democratic Party, Hillary Clinton would speak about something of import, something that actually matters, like maybe a foreign policy analysis or an economic analysis of where the country is, or some kind of a something with weight. But instead, she decided to use the old gerrymander of the left and pick two very trivial examples and hold them up as examples of racism and sexism. She she brought up two issues. Firstly, she mentioned that a reporter in the press pool, April Ryan, had been, I guess, unduly criticized by Press Secretary Sean Spicer, that Sean Spicer actually spoke up. Apparently, this was a reporter who was incessantly weaving this conspiracy about the Russians. You know, the Kremlin is secretly manipulating the administration, or that they put them in power. You know, this kind of demented leftist conspiracy theory that they continue to weave. And Spicer spoke up and said, look, you know, this is getting ridiculous. I don't know exactly what he said. But apparently, because this reporter happens to be black, Hillary Clinton has said that this is an example of, or an accusation that Press Secretary Spicer and therefore the administration has something against black men and women. And since she's black, this is why they did this. They don't like her because she's black, since they don't like black people. And also the fact that she's a woman, I guess that Hillary got a double header on that one, because they also hate women, right? They want to keep women barefoot and pregnant. They think women should be oppressed. So she criticized Spicer for having the temerity to criticize this reporter, not because she's a reporter, but because she's a black woman. And the second one she brought up was Bill O'Reilly, who of course has nothing to do with the administration. Made an offhand joke about Maxine Waters, who is another one of these people who weaves this conspiracy theory. She says Trump has to be impeached immediately. It's this daily narrative. Because he said that she looks like, her hair looks like James Brown. She looks like she's wearing a James Brown wig. Now, also we should point out that Maxine Waters also happens to be black, and she happens to be a woman, so therefore this is being weaved as a proof that Bill O'Reilly has, as a white man, criticizing her, has something against black men and women, in this case, a black woman. And thus, his reputation is being besmirched because of this comment, right? And this is what Hillary's talking points have been. This has been, and I don't know what the rest of the speech was. I didn't see the speech. All I did was read about the headlines of it as it's been covered by the media, both print and radio. And this has been the focus of the commentary. This is what you know, brought the speech out to the fore. Plus her slogan, she came up with some kind of nutty slogan, resist, da-da-da-da-ba-da-ba-do, whatever it is. But I want to comment on this accusation, because I would have thought that the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States, which is something that I find to be glorious and I celebrate every day and I'm thrilled over. I think this country is saved as a result of that. That his election would have at least put a clink in the armor, if not caused the undoing of this tyrannical, politically correct weapon. The politically correct weapon to which I refer, which I think was responsible for Hillary losing the election, and I think it was responsible for the Democratic Party losing the last elections over the past maybe 6 years, the midterms, is this idea that the enemy can be smeared as having something against a person because of their race, gender, ethnic background, sexual orientation, whatever. In fact, Hillary Clinton laid this agenda out explicitly when she made a comment during the campaign referring to her opponents as Trump supporters as a basket of deplorables. And then she listed exactly what they were: racist, sexist, homophobic, Islamophobic, and xenophobic, which is a new one. But all of these things thrown in to her litany of what constituted a basket of deplorables. And I think that it was that attitude, that view, that agenda that caused her to lose. And concurrently, it was the fact that Donald Trump not only didn't kowtow to this sort of tyranny, but he stood up to it and said, nope, you know, and he made politically incorrect comments, which, by the way, would have been passable if a liberal had said them. And he just was like, hey, no, I don't have anything against anyone. You know, I reject this whole premise. I am wanting to make America great for all people, all Americans. And his career proves that, you know. I mean, his decades of being in business, he actually has never promoted or demoted anyone based upon their race or gender. In fact, his company, as pointed out by his daughter Ivanka, is more female than male in terms of high positions, and that women are paid equally to men in his company, which is, you can't say the same for the Obama administration or for the Secretary of State Clinton's office. And so, you know, besides the fact that the truth bore out in the emptiness of those sorts of charges, there was a more fundamental understanding that by challenging this tyranny, Donald Trump was standing up for the rest of us who cower in fear at the possibility that we could be likewise attacked. And we could be. Anyone who doesn't genuflect to the left runs the risk. And that even includes leftists who might take a contrary position. They run the risk of being smeared like that. Racist, sexist, homophobe, Islamophobe, blah, blah, blah. And so I want to address the issue because, unfortunately, it hasn't gone away. And it probably never will go away. It is the weapon of the left, and they still are wielding it, as proof by Hillary coming out of the retirement and suddenly making a public speech where she mainly used her capital to make these ugly accusations against two people because of some silly offhand remark that they should be destroyed over this. And the bottom line is this. With regard to race and gender theory, which is also, by the way, becoming quite predominant or at least quite current on college campuses, including right here at Tufts University, I would simply suggest that racism is not a big problem in this country anymore. I think it certainly was in history. You know, our traditions, the great stain on our history is the fact that we had slavery and we had Jim Crow, and we had racism, and it was part of the government policy, as in, laws and whatnot, and that this was a despicable and shameful part of our history. And that, yes, people have sensitivities about race. You know, there are stereotypes that occasionally are under the sort of the hood, as it were. We do have racial tension, and I would point out that that's partially because we are so racially diverse. It's very easy for countries which are not to point an accusatory finger. But really, the truth is that particularly since the Civil Rights Act of 1965, which was, by the way, a Republican agenda going all the way back to the Civil War, and the removal of racism as a policy by the government, racism is no longer an issue in this country. And the result has been, and I think this is occurring even with the Civil Rights Act, even with Jim Crow, that African Americans were emerging and assimilating into the middle class and into the upper middle class and into the working class, just like everyone else. And I think that had the left not taken a hold of this issue, really in the late 60s, starting in the, you know, with the war on poverty, so to speak, then we would be a lot further along today regarding race questions. We wouldn't be worrying about some trivial comment about James Brown's hair, you know. I mean, in a sense, it shows how far we've come that you have to put a microscope up to such a high degree that we would find a racist cell somewhere, you know, a racist under the hood. And the truth of the matter, I would argue, is that really, starting in the 1960s, which was a very prosperous decade, black people really began to emerge in a big way into the middle class, and that has continued along in spite of the efforts of the left. But the left would not leave that alone. Instead, they started implementing programs, many of which were on the federal level, that I would argue damaged the black community. It damaged black entrepreneurialism with their anti-business attitudes in big cities. It damaged the black family, which was intact, according to Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who wrote a report about this as Lyndon Johnson's Assistant Secretary of Labor in 1965. He issued a report basically warning the administration and pointing out that the black family at that point, about 80% of the community was intact, and that these new kind of war on poverty programs and these new Great Society programs would damage that family. He was right. I mean, there's no question about that. So these programs basically disintegrated or damaged the black family. Women were given financial help if they got rid of their husbands or their male partners. They got more financial help if they had children out of wedlock. There's no question about that. That's history. And the result is that you have an increase in a community of young people growing up without a father in the home. And that, combined with the anti-business attitudes, which hurt black entrepreneurialism, not to mention the damage to the black church by anti-religious views that hurt one of the most fundamental moral components that drove the black community, the Christian church, which I think inspired all of Christianity in America. These things led to a situation by which you had an increase in crime, you had an increase in poverty, you had an increase in violence, the introduction of street drugs was damaging, and you had a breakdown in a community, and it affected a lot of people, not just black people, but it affected black people disproportionately. And I think if you take a look at all of these factors, plus, you know, liberal judges letting criminals out on the street and, you know, putting chains on law enforcement to try to stop criminals from terrorizing These neighborhoods, predominantly black neighborhoods, I'd point out, when 98% of the people in those communities are just trying to live a peaceful life and maybe get to work, get to school. With damaging teaching modalities in these big, rotten public schools, which were creating illiterates. You know, there was a study done recently which showed that a very high percentage of people in prison are illiterate or are functionally illiterate, thanks to some of these teaching modalities like look, say, reading, you know, which scrambles a young person's brain. It prevents them from developing a phonetic reflex so they can read properly. That was another leftist program, by the way. All of these programs combined had the effect of damaging the black community. And so the last people, the last line of defense is the policeman. I mean, that's the only one who can go in there and actually try to help the community protect itself against thugs and criminals, most of which are products of this leftist social agenda. And of course, now you have a war against them during the Obama administration and Black Lives Matter, which I think has blood on its hands, you know, when it, in terms of killing policemen, right? And so then they point a finger at the rest of us and say, we're racist. I think that we could take a look in the mirror, hold a mirror up to them and see who the real racists are. Will the real racists please stand up, as they say, right? But I want to get into the philosophy here, the fundamental belief that has led Hillary Clinton, the head of the Democratic Party, to use her political capital to attack two people for being racist or sexist because of some silly comment they made and try to destroy them instead of actually taking something serious. And that is that this goes back to the Marxist theory of, or conspiracy theory of exploitation, of oppression. Now, today I said I was going to talk about racism and oppression. Well, that's what this is about. I mean, this is just the same old socialist dialectic dressed up to fit the times. It was in the 1960s that Marxist theoretician Franz Fanon, the author of Guide to the Oppressed, or whatever his book was called, decided that instead of a class conflict, the communist movement would have to switch to a race conflict and a regional conflict. In other words, they would pit people against each other based upon race, and they would categorize one race as oppressed and the other as privileged. And so they would then stir up this dialectical war. And in some cases, that was a literal war. In other cases, it was philosophical, in order to move the ball forward toward a more socialist world. Ultimately, the ultimate dream, as described in the Communist Manifesto, being the international ant colony, where everything is absolutely equal, and where the individual is subsumed into this unnatural and evil condition that they call collectivism. And thus you had this, we were set up for this conflict between, as liberals like to say, the haves and the have-nots, which is another euphemism for this idea of the privileged and the oppressed. And that the people that are named and the people that were implied in Hillary Clinton's famous screed about the deplorables are people who are considered to be oppressed. That includes, you know, what euphemistically is called people of color, which is a new kind of leftist construct. This is what we call it, people of color. And that can mean a lot of different people. That these are people who are parts of groups that are oppressed, according to this Marxist paradigm, and that the rest of us are privileged. Now, what it comes down to in today's parlance is that those of us who are considered, quote, privileged are people who are determined to be white and male and straight. everyone else who is determined to be non-white, non-male, and gay is oppressed, right? And since they consider the United States to be a white, male society-run society, therefore America is privileged, and any nation that is not that is oppressed. So you have this dialectic, and you have this accusation that somehow, and of course implicitly in that is anyone who doesn't genuflect to this view, and that includes minorities, they can be a part of the privileged. And you'll notice that oftentimes people who are not of the privileged ilk, people who go outside of this equation, which is that they're not straight white men, you know, they are viciously attacked. Look at Clarence Thomas, right? He is the highest ranking African American in office in America today. You know, he is a Supreme Court justice. And yet he was not mentioned in the Smithsonian Institute Museum of African American History. Or he was like mentioned just very briefly, I should point out, really given short shrift, let's put it that way. I mean, this was a museum that's run by leftists, obviously, because Clarence Thomas has had the courage and the conviction to be an individual who did not goose step to the left. He did not conform to this idea of privilege versus oppression. Look what they did to, in 2008, to Sarah Palin, right? Picked by John McCain as his running mate, former governor of Alaska, maybe not the brightest and best person to have he should have picked, admittedly. But the hatred and the viciousness and the ugliness of the attack against her, and the attack against her as a woman by the left. You know, this was after we had heard month after month after month of commentary from the New York Times and from all of the liberal establishment media outlets and from talk show hosts like Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here locally about how we have to elect someone who is black or someone who's a woman or someone who's Hispanic. And they would constantly be analyzing the race. This candidate who's black can be that candidate who's a woman, who could be this candidate who's both black and a woman. That's all we heard about. We heard nothing about substance, nothing about where they wanted America to be in the world, nothing about their economic philosophy, nothing about their approach to the Constitution, all about what they were, right? And then all of a sudden, John McCain picks a woman, quote, to be his running mate, and all hell broke loose. I remember this. You know, I was like, oh, my God. I mean, the attacks, I'll never forget that Halloween accompanying some children, you know, doing trick-or-treating. And there were people dressed in Sarah Palin outfits of the ugliest and most sexist kind you can imagine. And so you have anyone who doesn't kowtow to this tyranny is really, really targeted and shut down. And I can give a lot of examples of this. I mean, I suppose the most recent example would be Kellyanne Conway in the Trump administration. Oh, my God. I mean, and, you know, just the nastiness of it and the sexism in the real sense of the attack against her is really should be, you know, her, you know, should make your toes curl. But because, you know, she doesn't genuflect to the left or their agenda, then it's okay. And what I would suggest is that this theory of exploitation, this theory of oppression, which is the central conspiracy theory of the left, it's simply wrong. It should be rejected. First of all, in the United States, we are all privileged. Everyone born in this country is privileged, regardless of your race or ethnicity or gender. Everyone here, everyone who is born in America should view themselves as privileged. We are privileged because we were born in a country that has created over centuries the freest and most prosperous and most independent society ever. We are an experiment where we derive our rights from God as opposed to rights from the state. That's what makes us different. That's what makes us an exceptional nation. That's why we are who we are. And as such, we are all privileged. And that includes a young black person who is born in a tough neighborhood because they have the opportunities before them to go up, to be free. They can get help. They can interact with people. They can develop skill and develop talent and be rewarded for those skills. That's not the case in other countries. Do you think that's the case in Russia or in certain African countries or even in certain, I don't know, Eastern European countries? I don't think so. Anyway, let me just see if I could take a PSA here. You're listening to Chuck Moore Speaks at WMFO 91.5 FM, Medford, Boston.
My new dad and I shot off a rocket in the park.
Today, my new son and I failed to shoot off a rocket.
He knew exactly what to do.
I had no clue what I was doing.
We set up the rocket. Hit ignition.
And then nothing. Sometimes I laugh when I'm frustrated.
Then out of nowhere, the rocket launched into the air.
The rocket did get into the air.
I've never seen anything fly so high.
And then crashed into a kite.
Look out!
And then the pond.
I'll never forget that day,
even if I tried.
You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of kids in foster care will take you just as you are. For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
It may be hard to believe, but people just like you are already saving money. FeedThePig.org makes it easy. Their simple savings plan teaches you how to start saving without going overboard. So you don't need to mooch off your friends.
You gonna finish that grape?
You mean the one in my mouth?
You don't need to stop buying the necessities.
What you're smelling is a natural musk.
Ew.
You don't need to be a medical test subject.
How do you feel?
Mostly okay. I... Sometimes, though.
You don't need to get a second job as a stuntman. You just need an internet connection. Don't get left behind. Start your personal savings plan with the tips and tools on feedthepig.org. That way, you don't need to sell your soul to the devil.
$15 is the best I can do.
All right, deal.
Brought to you by the American Institute of CPAs and the Ad Council.
And we are back. You're welcome to join the program. Let's see, 855-915-WMFO, 855-915-9636. The program is podcasted on iTunes and Stitcher. If you'd like to listen to the rerun of it, it's also live streamed on Facebook, so you can check that out on the Uberman Facebook page or Chuck Morse Facebook page. You're listening, of course, to WMFO 91.5 AM, Medford. So I would suggest, I would ask my listeners here who are Tufts University students here at this flagship station. Are you into this kind of oppression victimization agenda? Are you part of that? Do you believe that somehow you're either oppressed or you're privileged because of the accident of your birth? Because if you do, you're being suckered. You're being had. You know, this is, you're wasting a lot of your time focusing on these things, which are, I think, are soul-crushing, as opposed to focusing on useful endeavors, things that can create, put you in a position where you could have an excellent career and you could actually make a contribution to yourself, your society, and the world. You know, you're Tufts University students. This is one of the best colleges in the country, if not the world. you have an opportunity to take advantage of this great opportunity to make something out of yourself rather than focusing on this sort of victimization agenda. However, looking at the reality of the way our society is set up today, I could understand why, on a practical level, you may very well want to benefit by the oppression agenda. You know, if you are considered a person that's in the oppression category, that's a valuable coin because you can add that to your resume. Let's be honest. You know, that's just a fact. Everyone does it, whether they want to admit it or not. Some people even cheat, like Elizabeth Warren, right? Checking off Native American in order to get tenure at Harvard and at University of Pennsylvania, right? And then listed as a woman of color in the Fordham Law Review or in some official scholarly review. You know, she was used that to get ahead, basically grab that spot from someone who actually is a Native American, putting aside the efficacy of such a program and the fact that even if she was 137th percent Native, that's not technically qualified under these affirmative action rules where they look at your blood. You know, they do a, you know, an analysis of exactly what your ancestry was. You know, I thought that was something the Nazis did, but let's not go there. Okay. I want to be careful. The fact of the matter is that, yeah, people use this as a way to get ahead. There is a whole profession around it. You know, while the left worked assiduously starting in the 1960s to damage the black community, and while they continue to fan the flames of racial, ethnic, group identity, collective identity, as opposed to advocating the growth of the person, the sovereign individual under God, which is the American way, there is a lot of careers that could be had, a lot of benefits that could be obtained from the enormous multi-billion, if not trillion-dollar cottage industries that have built up around the detritus that they caused, right? All the social ills and the social disruptions that their big nanny state government caused various people. You know, the result is that you have social problems. You know, you have social problems that come about from welfare, from allowing crime to exist in a community by letting out criminals or by attacking the men who are trying and women who are trying to stop the criminals, like the policemen. You've got problems when you destroy the church or damage the church so the people no longer have a belief in a creator of the universe, a God, you know, a lawgiver. You know, something outside of themselves that, that gives life a bigger purpose than just being a bag of bones. I mean, you know, we're not just material. You know, they deal with the results of an education system that dumbs down our children by removing, you know, understanding of how the Constitution works and belief in God and replaces it with look, say, reading, which is a way of turning reading into a pictograph. You know, you're developing, you're studying reading like it's a hieroglyphic. You know, instead of learning how to sound out the vowels and the consonants and then put them together and develop a reflex that will help you not only read but comprehend, instead they're turning it into, you know, little pictures, you know, like hieroglyphics, which results, according to many studies, including a prominent Harvard University professor whose name escapes me right now, back in the late 1960s, it results in things like ADD and dyslexia. My good friend Dr. Samuel Blumenfeld, who passed away last year and who I miss and who did many programs with me, has wrote a whole shelf of books on this topic. This is a deliberate dumbing down of our people, all of us. And it particularly is affecting minorities because the welfare system and the crime and the other agendas of the left have damaged their families, so they don't have the resources to sort of ameliorate the problems and help their children, overcome this destructive agenda in our school systems. And so you've got, people who have grievances and who are then encouraged to think collectively. They think of themselves as part of a group and view that as having some kind of a value. You know, our new immigrants are encouraged to retain loyalty to, even, or certainly strong identity with, the ethnic background or the political or national background of the country to which they fled. In many cases, these were miserable socialistic hellholes that they were coming out of so that they could come to the land of the free. You know, our social contract used to be to encourage Americans to assimilate. Now, when I say assimilate, I don't mean forget your past identity, forget your religion, forget your culture. I mean, I could give you the example of ultra-Orthodox Jews who they dress a certain way, they conduct their affairs a certain way, they have dietary laws, but they're as American as apple pie. I mean, they are assimilated in that sense. You know, they've embraced this country. Today, we're teaching new immigrants to put their identity first by which they came from. Rather than to embrace an American ethos, an American culture. And so, you know, you have this identity politics. And I would also say that this oppression versus privilege paradigm, this new dialectic, this new conflict, it has some very bad effects on individuals. It's really ultimately extremely racist and it's sexist in that those who embrace it tend to look upon, for example, African Americans in this particular case, literally as different than them, that they're actually of a different consciousness. I mean, I've heard it leftist circles talk about black consciousness or female consciousness, as if there really is something different, which there's not. We're all individuals. And that they subscribe certain cultural elements and antecedents to someone who may be happen to be black or a woman or whatever, as if this is something that that defines them, that they need to embrace, which they don't. I mean, every individual relates to these things or doesn't relate to these things as they see fit. The idea of imposing these things and these judgments on someone, which is a leftist agenda, is in and of itself racist and sexist. And furthermore, the liberal establishment, I mean, I'm talking about in general, the left liberal Eastern Seaboard establishment, they view black people as if they're children, that they need to be helped. It's a very condescending sort of British colonial, Rudyard Kipling, white man's burden sort of racism. You know, that the black man needs a hand up. And, you know, it's wrong. Yeah, I mean, you know, you have people now on college campuses, you know, because they're now technically part of this privileged group. They think that they have to give money to another student who happens to be black because they're part of the oppressed group. That's not helping anybody. It's not even true. I mean, look, I mean, I'll use my own anecdotal, but one of the things that I do besides this radio show and writing columns for Newsmax and doing podcasts and selling insurance policies is I drive Uber. And in that capacity, and it's a wonderful thing, it's fascinating, and it's something I love doing, I've driven in all the neighborhoods of Greater Boston and the city of Boston, and I meet people from all walks of life. It's amazing. And I don't think that, you know, black people or women or anyone else are any different than anyone else. They don't need any extra help. They're just, we're all, I mean, I hate to break it to the left, but, you know, we're all the same, right? We're all looking for the same opportunities. If you really want to help black people, you'll encourage business. You know, you'll support President Trump, quite frankly, and his attempt to throw out onerous, bad business regulations so people can make a buck, so people can develop a business. They can start to accumulate some capital. You know, you'll support this agenda of, you know, getting rid of and keeping taxes lower so that there can be more capital accumulation and thus more investment and more economic opportunity. And you'd encourage businesses to open, expand and build and to come to this country from foreign countries and invest in the United States. I mean, that's the crux of the Donald Trump agenda. You would support that if you actually wanted to reduce whatever racism you think is out there, whatever sexism you think is out there. You would support creating more opportunity. You would support our free market system, but you don't. And that gets to why you believe what you do, which has nothing to do with helping anybody but your agenda and, quite frankly, your own cottage industries, multi-billion dollar publicly funded industries that have been built up to address and to claim to solve the very problems that you're largely responsible for creating. Okay, so welcome to the program. You're welcome to join me, Chuck Morse, as we reach the final segment of the hour. 855-915-9636. Come on down, 855-915-9636. Love to hear from you. Okay, so the big story today is this Russian conspiracy. There's an investigation being conducted by the FBI under Commissioner James J. Edgar Comey. And there has been this investigation going back, I think, almost 6 months, which is, firstly, whether or not the Russians interfered in our election, and secondly, whether or not they interfered on the side of Donald Trump. And the third question is whether or not, if they did, the Trump administration or even Donald Trump himself knew about it. And that's really what the story continues to bump along. And even after 6 months, I don't think that there's any evidence that Trump had any coordination. I think there is evidence that the Russians tried to interfere in the election, probably. I wouldn't doubt that. But there's not a shred of evidence to back up the conspiracy theory that Trump himself or that Trump's team was colluding with the Russians. It just isn't. And if there was, we'd know about it by now. You know, having Jeff Sessions meet with the Russian ambassador, that was his job as the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee. He met with a lot of ambassadors, but that's been woven into this conspiracy theory. I mean, Rachel Maddow, when she did that famous piece where she was allegedly releasing Donald Trump's tax returns, which, by the way, is illegal, she said, he was landed at an airport at the same moment or the same day as this Russian oligarch. You know, this kind of like, you know, tin hat conspiracy stuff is just, it's relentless every single day. It reminds me of Iran-Contra in a way. I mean, Iran-Contra was used as a weapon to slow down, if not stop, Ronald Reagan in his final years in office. And it continued on throughout the Bush years, Bush Sr. Oh, there's an investigation, there's a threat. It was very little to it. I mean, there was something to it. I mean, there was, you know, I mean, we don't want to go back and rehash it. But the point is that the liberal media kept banging that drum every single, maybe, you know, 3, 4, 5 times a week. You would hear some new thing, and there was just new analysis. We'd hear about the milieu this, and the analysis. And they continued pounding that drum right up until the moment that the election of 1992 took place and Bill Clinton won. The next day they dropped it. It disappeared. It was really nothing more than an attempt to slow down the agenda of Ronald Reagan, right? You know, they couldn't take Reagan on politically or philosophically because they knew they'd lose. So they continued to resort to this kind of external sort of conspiracy, the shrouded in mystery, innuendo thing, this attack. And that's what this Russian thing is about with Trump. They can't take Donald Trump on when it comes to creating the better business atmosphere that he wants to create, or stopping criminal aliens from coming into the country and deporting those who are here, or strengthening America's position in the world after the disastrous years of Barack Obama, where we saw the rise of ISIS and international Islamic terror and the destruction of friendly regimes. You know, they can't defend that. So instead, they're going to keep twisting this conspiracy theory about the Russians and constantly be called for more investigation. Listen, if there was something there, I'm sure it would have come out by now. There's nothing to it. You know, did the Russians collude? I mean, I think that if they did, and if they were colluding on behalf of Trump, it was probably because they thought Trump would be the weaker president. You know, Russia is out for Russia. And that Hillary is surrounded by all of these neocons, you know, like Wolfowitz and others, the people in the Bush administration who all came out in support of her and who was rattling a saber at Russia. She wanted a war with Russia. They're still talking about a war with Russia. If she was elected, we probably would be at war with Russia. Who knows? Whereas Trump wanted to disengage. He wants to stop America's perpetual wars. He wants to, you know, get it over with. Defeat ISIS, you know. Hello, you're on the air.
I'm just wondering why you're defending Donald and Russia so much.
I'm not defending Russia. But I am saying that this conspiracy theory that claims that Donald Trump, you know, was helped by Russia is just that. There's no proof of it. Or do you know something?
Do you think that his associates did, in fact, meet with the Russian ambassador?
Yeah, they did. Well, I think that Jeff Sessions met with him because that's what he did as the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. I don't think he was meeting with
sure
him to
no
say
one else in the Armed Services Committee has ever met with the Russian ambassador before.
Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but I honestly don't think that Jeff Sessions said, let's meet with the Russian ambassador so we can plan on how to defeat Hillary Clinton. There's no evidence of that. You know, maybe it'll come out. Look, it's been investigated for 6 months, and there's been nothing that's come out to indicate that. Do you know that Obama's secretary of... Well, Obama's secretary of the CIA has said that there's no evidence of it. That being James
That's
Clapper. Yeah.
What about Donald Trump Jr. saying that a lot of his investments are coming from Russia?
A lot of their investments came from Russia?
He's quoted a
yeah,
few years
I don't have a problem with that. Do you? I mean, that's they're private business people. They can invest in Russia and or anywhere they want. That's none of our business.
Do you think he should release his tax returns?
I personally think that he should, and I wish he would, but he doesn't have to. I mean, the law, that started with Nixon. Before Nixon, no president released the tax returns. And I actually think that he should, but, you know, I don't think anyone has a right to find them and release them. That's a crime.
Okay. Well, appreciate you talking to me, but I think you're letting him off the hook. I think it's kind of pathetic.
All right. Thank you for calling.
All right.
Bye-bye. You're welcome to join me in the final segment here. Chuck Morse at WMFO, 855-915-9636. 855-915-9636. Am I being too soft on Trump? Look, I think, again, I mean, was there Russian involvement in the election? I would say probably. We don't know. But I would think that they probably would have wanted to see Hillary elected, not Trump. I mean, we do know, according to the New York Times, which did, let me just see, I'm going to call this one up. I've got the a link to the article. An article that appeared in April 23rd, 2015 in the New York Times called Cash Flow to Clinton Foundation Amid Russian Uranium Deal. Now, you can look this up. It's online. In this article, the New York Times, liberal establishment media outlet, they said that Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, signed off on a uranium deal that allowed a Russian front company from Canada to purchase American uranium and assume control over one-fifth of American uranium supplies and production. Now, this is a national security question. To give the Russians uranium access in the United States? And she's, as Secretary of State, was in a position to give a green light to that, to change that policy. This deal, damaging to national security and partially hidden from the Obama administration, was followed by millions of dollars pouring into the Clinton Foundation and a $500,000, quote, honorarium given to former President Bill Clinton, who then proceeded to deliver a speech in Moscow. So I guess we'd have to ask ourselves which side was more in bed with the Russians. I think that Hillary, with this uranium deal, which brings up issues of national security, you know, for money for the Clinton Foundation. I mean, who knows what else might be going on there? The Clinton Foundation, by the way, that's something that really ought to have been investigated. It seems a bit, one of my major criticisms of Trump is that he's swept that under the rug. He seems to have let that go. But we know that there was evidence, and this is, again, the New York Times, not me, that they were making these deals with this Moroccan gun runner. I mean, God knows what else they were doing. Talk about corruption in exchange for enormous amounts of money pouring into that foundation. It seems to me that the Russians kind of had Hillary's number, so to speak. I mean, you know, she'd been compromised. I think that they probably, if they were interfering in our election, I think it could be argued that they wanted Hillary to win, not Trump. Now, I also want to just bring out another little fact here, and that is that, you know, there are people on the left who like to spin this conspiracy theory about the Russians. But yet I've discovered, according to my research, that several of them are on the Russian payroll as radio and hosts and as media commentators working for Russian television, RT. Now, if you don't believe me, go to the Russian television website and look it up. It's all there. I have links to it on an article that's going to be going into Newsmax next week. RT, Russian television, has been described as the Russian propaganda arm. It's partially, Vladimir Putin actually owns a portion of it, right? They have growing influence in the American left, and they have media commentators, including Tom Hartmann, Ed Schultz, and Mike Papantonio, all of whom are, they've got icons on the RT website, and I assume that they're paid by RT. You also have more mainstream commentators like Larry King and Peter Lavelli. They're also on the RT website. So you want to talk about being influenced by the Russians. These are the same people who are on the vanguard of this attack on Donald Trump, right? Are they making the attack from a Russian platform? Apparently they are. Now, again, this is documented. If you don't believe me, go to RT, Russian television. Just do a Google, and you will see the media page, and it's amazing, actually. There they are, you know, with their icons. I mean, they're working for RT, all right? And this all while they accuse Trump of this dark conspiracy theory. Now, I just want to point out that as we reach toward the end of the program, I view the election of Donald Trump as almost miraculous. I find it to be a glorious phenomenon. I bask in it every day because I just think this country really saved itself. We really bit the bullet by electing President Trump. We reversed this slide into corruption that the Clintons represented, but more fundamentally, we reversed a set of ideas that the Clintons represent. I mean, Hillary Clinton coming out of retirement to attack two people for being racist, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Trump stands for a principle that seems radical to some, but is actually pretty common sense because it's normal, and that is the idea of putting America first. And when he talks about putting America first, he means all Americans. And this is a normal thing for any nation to do. If this was Zimbabwe, I'd want to put Zimbabwe first. If this was, you know, Myanmar, I'd want to put Myanmar first. Any sovereign nation puts its own interests first. So, and yet we haven't done that. We haven't had, certainly Barack Obama wasn't doing it. Barack Obama was, you know, he actually went to the United Nations to get ratification for this really awful Iran treaty. He didn't even go to Congress because he knew he'd lose there. He did an end run around our own government to get that approved. I could give a lot of examples of where the Obama administration sought to undermine American sovereignty and move us toward some sort of an international order. And it isn't just Obama either. I think George W. Bush was involved in that too. It's not even it's Democrat and Republican. Donald Trump is one of the first people to stand up and say, no, we're going to put our own nation first, our own sovereignty first, because it's not only right, but it's progressive. It's democratic. Just like we put our family first, ourselves first. This is what life is. You put yourself first. First, you can't help other people until you take care of yourself. You know, I mean, it exists in the animal kingdom. Animals, you try to interfere with the space of a dog, you'll get your hand bit. You try to interfere with a beaver's dam, you'll get, you know, who knows what'll happen. I mean, animals understand this. This is natural. You put your nation first for the same reason that you put your family first, your community first, and yourself first. It is the normal, natural, progressive thing to do. And yet we haven't done it until now. So for that reason alone, Donald Trump is truly a revolutionary figure. And whether you agree with him or not on particulars, and there are certainly many areas where we can disagree with him, we ought to thank him for doing this one thing. It is an extraordinary accomplishment. Anyways, I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. My books are available at Amazon. My column is available at Newsmax. My podcast is available at iTunes, which, by the way, will include this program as podcasted. And again, I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. Have a good day, everybody. Let me see if I can get this out.
Everybody loves the cha-cha-cha. The little children like the cha-cha-cha. They like the cha-cha-cha. They like the cha-cha-cha. Everybody likes the cha-cha-cha.
In ignition.
Took my baby to the hop last night. And what to my surprise, when we got there, she hit me with the news right between the eyes. She said she couldn't do the cha-cha-cha. She couldn't do the cha-cha-cha. She couldn't. No, she couldn't cha-cha-cha. Ooh, my baby couldn't do the cha-cha-cha. I told her not to worry. They
every song they played was the cha-cha-cha. Every song they played was the cha-cha-cha. Tom Dooley, cha-cha-cha, cha-cha-cha. Ooh, every number was the cha-cha-cha.